All right. Today I get the opportunity to interview Chris Witowicz. Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Oh, absolutely. No problem. Thank you for having me.
You're the first person I've interviewed that I worked with, I coached with, as a cutter. So this is going to be different for me, but I'm excited to kind of, actually ask you some different questions and maybe get to know you a little deeper than I had before.
Awesome. Sounds great.
I want to start out by asking if you were developing a highlight reel, Chris's top little five moments, what would you put at the top? What's the one memory, the one experience, the highlight for you as you rode or were involved in Little Five so far?
Yeah, that's a tough one because you got 1997, and then you got 2000, which are totally different experiences and equally at the top. If I had to, maybe 10 years ago, I'd probably say definitely 2000 because that like cemented the legacy and everything. But honestly, nothing can top the 1997 victory. It just it was unexpected. It just happened so quickly. I was so young and didn't really know anything, and how it all came together at the end was just out of this world. Like, and then ending, culminating with, Lance Armstrong coming to the party and doing all that. It was just a, you can't, it's hard to even explain how amazing that ride was. But
That's also my top little five experience of
really.
everything I've been through. When people ask me, it's easy for me to drop into to that moment, that day. For many ways, that shaped my life, really. If you and your teammates hadn't been there for me and we had that opportunity together, like I wouldn't be where I am today. I'm sure of it.
I know. And same with me. I mean, it shaped my life, ever since then. I've been involved with Little Five, and it was just you came on at the right time and kind of saved the program while we were in a little bit of disarray, and everyone was training hard, and we still had a team and all that, but it was our coach moved to California, and or the coach at the time, Eric Gullett, you were also the coach, but it was kind of a dual coaching thing, and we were kind of like, what do we do now? And you just came on and took over, and I just listened to you, and it all worked out. And yeah, it was we were what, qualified 19th, and I didn't even make the quals team that year, which is always fun to tell my riders, that I used to coach all the time. I would, every time there was like a, oh, I want to make the quals team or I need to be on this, I'm like, well, I didn't even make the quals team, so it always like helped bring down the importance of qualifications. It'd be easier.
Let's break that down. Let's break that year down a little bit. You said it was unexpected. Like, why'd you say that? And what was the team like, let's say, going into that school year?
Yeah, so there was I think seven of us that started the team, and my, I looked at all the other riders, and I felt like I was like either the sixth or seventh guy on the team. And I wasn't expecting to race at all. Todd Neville approached me on the side of the road, and I think I'd ridden with cutters one time the previous year. I'd rode for a dorm called Wilkie, and had some good riders on that team that kind of helped me get started. But then I quickly, tore my ACL and was out for the year, and I came back and I didn't get my ACL repaired. And so I was really excited to hear about, the team, and, they're going to go on a training trip and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, I'm going to do it, but I hope they understand that I cannot do an exchange. And like, I don't know if I'll ever make a team. So I just wanted to be part of it. And I just kind of kept going along, and, I got myself one of those funky, huge knee braces to
I remember
exchanges on the rocks in front of, the football stadium or the basketball stadium, and yeah, got some bloody noses, and but my knee never gave out, and then we figured out a way that I didn't have to wear the knee brace because it was killing my power in my right leg. It was like suffocating me. So, but yeah, that year just started off with no expectations, and then we scheduled a time trial, a 5 mile time trial on Bottom Road, and I got really like focused and motivated for it, and then I ended up like winning that time trial by like 50 seconds. I remember it like Thursday, and over to second place guy, and I think everyone was kind of shocked. And from there, you know, one of our seniors quit the team, or two of them maybe, that year. And so it was kind of like all of a sudden I got put up there in our number one spot. But at the same time, we had a swimmer coming in, Sam Gosowski, who was like an All-American. He was an amazing swimmer. And then our Big Ten champ, he was. And then we had Aaron Pilling, who had raced a couple of years before, and they were coming onto the team late. So once they got there, it kind of cemented and made things a little better, but they were also not in great shape at that point. So they had to kind of quickly get up to speed. And then it all just came together right at the end. It's really hard to, you know,
we had Casper from the Netherlands.
Absolutely. Yeah. Casper was awesome. He, you know, he loved riding, and he was tall like me, and we were able to do an exchange together. That was, might've been the only exchange I ever did. but yeah, he was just a solid core guy, and we needed those other guys to come in and get in shape, and yeah, it all worked out.
I don't remember if we even did the series events that year, or if we were just like so far just trying to get a team together to get to race day.
Yeah, we did not do any series events that year. If I remember, we did Team Pursuit, I think, the following year, and did pretty well. But yeah, I was kind of always nervous of, I didn't want to, you know, I was training really hard, and I didn't want to hurt my confidence, you know, by doing those events. And for whatever reason, I don't know if you guys did series events before that, but it just seemed like everyone was on board with me not doing, missing out. And I didn't want to crash. And I didn't want a bad experience in my head of being in the wrong position. And I was like, I'll just figure it out on race day. And, but I wasn't even the sprinter. So I wasn't expecting to be that guy. Actually, Aaron did missing out, and he eliminated in the first round because he boxed himself in and didn't really get a chance to see how well he did. But other than that, we never did it.
So you make your way up to a pretty good time trialer on our team. You're going in the race. You're not supposed to be the finisher.
Right. Right.
When do you realize, or were you thinking that you're good at this, or are you still just trying to figure it out even on race day?
Oh no, I knew I was, I guess I knew I was good when I did that time trial. And so from there I started training with, some of our alumni like Greg Crisco and, you know, Ryan Warren and those guys. And I think spring break is when I really figured out that I could keep up with those guys, because they were just launching attacks left and right, and I was able to hang on their wheel and just dive from wheel to wheel, and you know, would never get dropped. So at that point, I felt like I was definitely a top endurance rider. Not a sprinter by any means, but I knew I could help get our team to the last lap in my mind, with Aaron as our sprinter. Then we'd have a chance and hopefully win, but you know, we're hoping to get at least top five, you know?
Yeah. But remind me how we even decided on Aaron being the finisher that year. Cause you know, that was my first year sort of coaching, right? The whole thing and being there. And Eric and I were just trying to keep it simple, 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 simple. Later on in my coaching, it gets more complicated. You start adding more layers and you start overthinking things. But that year, we were trying to keep it simple.
Yeah.
So how did we pick Aaron to going in the race day to be the finisher?
He had the fast twitch muscles that you could not even top for 15 seconds. Sam Gosowski it turned out to be probably even a better sprinter later on when he had a year or two under his belt, but he was just coming out of swimming. So his legs were just adapting to all the riding, and, you know, he was beat up a lot from all the training he had to do. And he just wasn't quite there yet as a little five sprinter. And quickly that next summer, he was amazing. So, you know, I put those guys on both as top sprinters that I could not beat in a sprint. But in the right situation. I felt like I was the right man for the job. But yeah, during that race, I just saw Aaron. I was feeling out of this world, and I could tell Aaron was a little bit gassed after maybe his first couple sets. He had to ride that first set, which was really difficult, and he's in 19th position. He got to the front in like one lap, and you know, I could just tell he was hurting from that a little bit, and you know, it was just a sprint, so he probably could have done well, you know, against the guy I went against. But at the same time, if he was attacked or anything, I was kind of worried that that guy might break away. So I think that's when I reached out to you and was like, let's just do it. And it just kind of happened. I can't believe you actually made that call. It was genius, but it was risky, right?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second, because that's a moment I remember for sure. So you say we qualified 19th. We didn't do any series events. We hadn't really been a big force in the race for a couple of years. So to say we were overlooked or underestimated by the competition is probably an accurate statement, wouldn't you say?
Oh, 100%. I don't think anyone even thought of us as a top five team, not even close.
We were even pitted on the backstretch, so we were certainly out of sight. And the like you said, there comes a moment in the race where you're riding and I notice you dancing to the music while you're on the bike, on the track. I'm like, wow, this is so easy right now for him. And you're just like head bobbing to some song. Like you're able to take that in that moment, your first time. That's when I kind of like, something's different. And then you get off the bike and you come up to me and say, Jim, I can lap the field right now. Just let me go.
Yeah, and that's right.
And I was thinking, calm your jets, cool down a little bit. Like, we're just trying to make it to the end of this race. But then it started to dawn on me and you and really eventually Aaron that we should switch the finishing order. And to Aaron's credit, he recognized it also, that was the right thing to do. It didn't put up any fight at all. We changed the rotation and we get you on the bike at the end of the race with 12 laps to go or so. It was a pretty big set at the end.
12 laps, yeah, which is, you know, doesn't happen very often these days. It's sometimes a 30 lap set, but
it was leading up to that race, it certainly didn't happen. That wasn't the norm. Yeah,
right. It was just out of necessity and the situation because their rider, Fiji's rider, Jim Lohman, was also on the bike for the last probably 15 laps or so. So it worked out perfect.
You're right. So we didn't want him to sneak away.
Exactly. That's kind of what we were worried about. And he wasn't a sprinter either. So it was like a good matchup for me, I thought. Yeah.
And it comes down to just you and Jim taking the white flag.
Yeah. Luckily for me, he let out, you know, I think Wolf was there, you know, from another team. He was lapped from Cinzano, and he whispered to me, he's like, I'll leave you out. And I was like, okay, sweet. But I think he pulled off, and then Lohman just kept, you know, pulling. And so he wasn't pulling hard or anything, but he was just allowing me to draft for 11 laps. And, you know, that was great. So I was just geared up to just take off at any time. But, you know, with just over a lap to go, I felt like that was the perfect time to, like, maybe surprise him and get a little bit of a gap to where I can hold it. And it somehow worked out. I was pretty happy with my last lap for not being a sprinter at all. I think it was a 31.3. I was like, that's about as good as you can get for a non-sprinter.
But, great. You just went for it. Coming out of turn four, checker flags flying, and you're in the lead. Jim is like nudging you on the outside, but you just put your head down and keep going. Like, what's that feeling for you when you take the checker flag, your first race?
Oh my God. it was surreal. He was like coming in on me, and I was like kind of trying to push back on him. And I kind of moved my bike a little bit, but it didn't affect him. I talked to him about that after the race. Luckily I didn't do anything like over the top. When I crossed that finish line, you know, obviously you want to throw your hands up, but I don't think I was good enough a bike handler to do that. So I just threw my hand up and it was just like, did that just happen? You know, like I expected to win at that point, but you can never be in that moment when it happens. You're just like, oh my God, you just do that. You throw your arms up and you're like, what just happened? Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and the pit's going nuts. Like we literally can't believe it. You know, like this just happened. The race came to us. Things just went our way. And it came down to a two-person sprint, which you did masterfully, and we won the race. and we're on the backstretch just celebrating, and like no one really knows what's going on because it was so unexpected.
That's why I say it's impossible to top that feeling. Like you can look at the two different years, but you'll never be in that moment to where it's like a shock in the world like that. Or at least the little five world.
And I remember the Fijis coming over to our pit, walking across the track and literally introducing themselves to us because they didn't even know you guys' names. Like you were not on their radar at all.
Like, right. Hey. The announcers didn't even know our names, that's for sure. I think he was calling Pilling on that last lap. But I can't find that video anymore, but I wish it was still around. Hopefully somebody's got it.
So that's the top moment on your highlight reel, right?
Yeah.
And that makes sense. If we were to reverse it, like what was the most frustrating moment? The moment where you were least satisfied with Little Five experience and you wish maybe you could, it kind of gnaws at you.
As a writer, yeah, I would probably have
writer, to as a coach, as whatever. Either it's race day or training or something.
I would say like, there's totally different as a coach and a writer. As a coach, you're constantly trying to, you know, get people to train hard and, you know, you're not expecting them to like match the effort that you put in or, you know, be as talent or be as like, fortunate or whatever, all that stuff you put into it. Like some people have more classes than you. Some people have jobs, they have girlfriends. I tried to eliminate most of that stuff from my life. And so it set the table easy for me. But I would say as a writer, the most frustrating thing was like, you know, when I would overtrain a little bit and then I would, I came into race day, like, you know, 2 weeks to go. And I just didn't have the power anymore. And I was feeling phenomenal before that, you know. And, you know, so just going that last 2 weeks leading up to that race, knowing that.
98.
Yeah, 1998. Knowing that I may not be the rider everyone expects me to be. And then I kind of did the exact opposite of the year before. And I was like, Pilling, you got to take the bike. Like, I don't feel like I have the power to sprint. And, you know, we almost got that one too. So it worked out. You know, I did okay on the race, but I just didn't have the power to like do anything I wanted compared to the year before.
Do you think it would have been different had you finished? Do you think you could have still won a race in hindsight or?
No, probably not the sprint. O'Brien was really fast. I think we maybe could have launched a little bit of an attack there and tried to get away from the pack, maybe. But, you know, I got him a big gap to get it back in. But maybe if I could have lasted one more lap out there and then he would have done the last four if I would have came out a lap later. But I don't know. They let me go. So maybe I should have just tried to go a little bit longer. But the other team won, and that's how it should be. You know, you can't win them all.
Is there any way you could have won all four? Probably not. Like,
No. I'm happy with what I got.
1999 is a frustrating moment for me when the team is having a pretty good race. You know, the riders aren't feeling super sharp, but we're in it. And then we crash with 13 to go. Right as you're about to get on the bike, you're actually standing in the pit the next lap, and there's this big crash. You know, then we're behind and the officials are yelling at you to slow down and the race is just going away from us. And next thing you know, the race is over.
Well, yeah, I think you just,
that's probably my most frustrating Little Five experience. I lost my cool.
Yeah, that was like the most frustrating, 15 minutes or whatever of of my career for sure. But yeah, I was thinking of like a longer term. But yeah, I agree with you on that. That was, I didn't even know what was going on. You were definitely more frustrated than me because I didn't even know what was going on. I was like, I've never been in a crash be situation before. We were way down when I finally got back on the bike, and then I couldn't even really see the other teams on the field, and I really didn't know what to look for at that time. So I remember you like, I think, yeah, you were like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "I don't know."
I was as frustrated, and not just you, not the officials, myself. Life was like not easy at that time, and I put too much like I needed that win too much for myself, not just the team. It was a frustrating moment all around.
Yeah, sure.
And
Sure.
like all those moments, it kind of helps us all kind of grow a little bit,
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How did you even get in the Little Five, or how'd you get to IU? Like, where'd that How'd that come about?
Well, yeah, my mom went to IU, and like she's got footage of her at the Little Five race, which I didn't even know about until 5 years ago or so. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what, like 1962 or 63? And I was like, this is amazing. And then my brother went to IU, so I wanted to go to IU, and I was an IU basketball fan. But then I tried to get in, and I was put on a waiting list. So I actually had my room at Purdue and was all ready to be a Purdue student. And then I got the call that I got pulled into IU, and I was like, all right, let's go. And I wasn't thinking about Little Five or anything at that time, but I did watch the movie, and I absolutely loved the movie. My dad was a cyclist, but like a touring type cyclist. He would just do like the Hilly Hundred and a few other events. So I always enjoyed cycling, and when people brought me into it, those guys that I mentioned from my dorm got me involved, but I never thought I was good enough to be on the Cutters because it to me there was like a almost like a pro cycling team, and I just didn't have the perception of I could be that guy someday. It was just they had to take me under their wing, and I just listened to whatever they told me, and it worked out.
Well, if you didn't think you could ever be a cutter, like, why did you put your name in a hat? Why'd you go for it?
Just because Todd,
Oh, really?
Todd just came approached me and said, "Would you like to ride?" I just didn't realize, oh, you just joined the team. That's it. Like, I thought you had to be like, have a bunch of experience and all that kind of stuff. And I was relatively new still and had that torn ECL, so I was not expecting to do anything like that.
And how were your teammates over the years of being a cutter? Like, I think you rode three races with Greg Sprague, right?
No, I always had he was always a good cog in the wheel, like he was he always had a practice, he played two sports, so he was what's that swimming sport where you throw
Water
the
polo.
water.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had some things to do, and he was a really good student and took more classes than me, so it was always like me trying to make sure that he was staying in shape, and like I was hoping to ride with him more, but he was just a steady cog in the wheel. He always, got there and always got the job done. In the end, was always in shape by spring, and so he was a great teammate to have. Always steady, you knew what to expect from him. So, yeah, and he's such a nice guy that like it was hard not to get along with him. Yeah.
How was it for you going from a kid joining a team, like not even sure he could make the cutters, to being eventually a leader on the team and a big presence in Little Five? Like, how did that evolve for you?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, you win and your head gets a little big, as most young people would say. So, and so, I wasn't like, it wasn't terrible, but at the same time, I was probably a little too big for my britches. And, I had my perception was everybody should just be doing what I'm doing, and why can't you do it that way? And I didn't expect everyone to be me, but at the same time, I set aside everything in my life just to try to win Little Five. I would make sure I'd only take 12 credits. I didn't have a job. All I wanted to do was win. And a lot of people have other, things going on in their life, and it's hard to find four guys that are have that same passion. And that's no knock against them. It's just like I don't know. I dove all in, and that's all I cared about.
Why was it so important for you? Like, why, what about this event captivated you?
Well, it's hard to say. Like, winning, once I won, then that's all you want to do. So that's, you know, it made it even more cemented in my head. But I don't know. I was a competitive swimmer, and I think you guys bringing all the stories to me about the program and the history, I think that really helped, like, facilitate, you know, me being more and more, like, passionate about it. It's almost like you watch a movie about something, and then you're more excited to, like, learn about that subject, you know, going forward. And you provided all that history for me and laid the table and made it easy for me to, you know, train. And seemed like the team was built around me those next 3 years. So, you know, I was always treated really well. And that's all, you know, winning was what I wanted. And, you know, I wanted to obviously graduate. And, but yeah, that's number one for sure. And it was because of you guys, probably, I would have to say.
Yeah, I know you did surround yourself with people who also cared about that event for some reason. And you're right, you don't always know why something is important to you. Like, maybe that's what life's all about, is just trying to figure out why you like the things you like.
Yeah, I'm really competitive, obviously. And so that was something I could latch on to. And when I was a swimmer in high school, I didn't start swimming until sixth grade, which is really late. And so, like, I almost made my dream. Like, we got second place at state, and we were really close to winning, and I got to swim on the state team. But I wasn't nearly as good as some of my teammates. So I could taste getting there, but I just wasn't quite there. And then little five came, and all of a sudden I, like, hit my peak. And, you know, it was all, that's all I, it's all I, it was fun.
Well, after you graduated, you kept riding for a while. Like, did you explore trying to be professional cyclist, or what got in your way there?
Yeah, a little bit. So Eddie, my friend from Munster that was a swimmer, funny enough, he, like, lived with Eddie B, the you know, the Olympic coach, the track cycling team, in 84. Like, he lived with him on his ranch, and he's like, oh, I can get you a place there. And he's still coaching riders. And so I did try to pursue that, and, you know, for about 6 months or so. But I re-tore my ACL as soon as I got there. And so my leg got really, really weak. And once I was able to start riding again, it, like, I jumped right in. Like, his first ride with me was an 80-mile ride with, like, we did 7 hill repeats before the 80-mile ride started, and it was in the mountains. And so by the end of that ride, I'm like, my legs are just shaking. I can barely, like, get back to the field. And then all of a sudden my knees started feeling better, and I was like, all right, let's go. And I got started winning some races and doing well. And then I got, like, sick, and I got homesick because I was sick, and I just decided to come back. And then I just raced a little bit and never really took full advantage of what I had. I probably should have, I didn't do what I was supposed to do, like Eric Young did, in terms of, like, setting myself 30 races a summer and just keep going and going and going. I think that's what's needed, you know, and I didn't pursue it the way I should have, but I'm okay with it now. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it bugged you a little bit or before.
Yeah. It's like, why couldn't, you know, I probably partied too much. That was one of the things. And not like, I wasn't like an alcoholic or anything, but I, you know, once a week go pretty hard, and, you know, it affects your training. And so I had a lot of friends, and, you know, I just didn't realize how that was affecting, you know, when I get sick, like, all the time. I was like, well, I just have, something's wrong with me. I have allergies all the time. But it was just, I think I was putting too much stress on my body trying to do two things. You can't be drinking when you're training.
Well, right. How do you, you're still involved in Little Five, right? You still coach the men's team right now?
Yeah, I'm kind of stepping away, letting some other guys take over now. Last year is like a full-time coach, and now I'm going to let some of the younger guys do it, and I'll help mm-hmm. out when I did, but.
Like, how did you have patience for riders as a coach when you're coaching women's and men's? like allowing them to be themselves, like hopefully we allowed you to be yourself. I know I was a little bit controlling here and there, but that's part of the key is letting writers be writers, because they are in college, they are young. It's an intramural sport.
I mean, it was crazy because when I first came in, I was young and brash, and like I was very opinionated and like very set in my ways. And I would just come in and like, all right, this is how we're doing it. And first time coaching girls, and I think that, a couple of them were terrified of me. I was just coming in and just saying things, and like I think it was a little too much, and I had to back off and kind of changed my approach completely, because I've never coached before, number one, and number two, I'm a guy and not a girl, so I had to really figure out how to like navigate that. And but I mean, we won our first year, so obviously it was a great first year. But over time, I tried to learn how to adapt my way, and it was every year was a new learning experience all the way to the end. So, it was different. You can't really force them to do anything, because you're a volunteer coach. I'm not being paid anything. They could just go and find a new coach whenever they want. So you can't be too hard on them, but at times you can if you have their trust. That's for sure.
We were talking about developing trust as a coach and a writer. How can you get the athletes to trust you? They'll do more, be a better team. Going into 2000 race, your senior year, you've got a pretty good team. Like, I know you really are determined to lap the field. Right. But I didn't trust you. I didn't trust you that you could do that. I didn't think that was the best tactical choice. As a coach, I also started overthinking things and thinking, making things a little more complicated. And leading into the race, the coaching staff, not the riders, thought that it would be best if we waited for a sprint. That would be the best tactical decision.
Yeah,
And
I remember.
you, I know you do. And your energy level changed. Like, your shoulders dropped. Like, you become a different person when we tell you that. And if we had continued that, we wouldn't have won that race. Like, you lost a lot inside. And then the morning of the race, actually during the warm-up of the race, out on the track, we I don't know why we came to our senses, really. We tell you, if you have it in you, if you want to go for it, go for it. Like, launch it. And then you took advantage of that. Like, talk me through that, like how you felt maybe untrusted, and like, it wasn't the highlight, but it turned out to be a good learning experience for me, for sure.
Yeah, it's like one of those last second decisions, kind of like the first race where everything changed at the last second, and it provided a spark for me. I remember sitting in that hotel room and with guys that I hadn't talked to all year, convincing me that it was best that I sprint. And in my mind, I wasn't a sprinter, and I was fortunate to go against another non-sprinter that first time around. And so while I thought I could win a sprint, I was going up against, future Cat One sprinters. They weren't Cat Ones at the time or anything, but I was a little bit concerned that I might make a mistake. I thought I had the speed, but if I made a little mistake or was boxed in, like, it's all over. And I just didn't want it to come down to that, and it wasn't my strength. And so I wanted to play to my strength no matter what it took. And I felt like on paper, the math worked out. Like, I was winning every time trial by over 30 seconds, it seemed like. And so I felt like there's, we had another good time trialer on the team and John Carlson, and I felt like, we would make it no matter what. And I didn't have, it was in practice, I was getting a half lap every time I would, when I tried it, and I would hold it. And so I was like, if I can get that half lap, then all we got to do is get the other half. And so that's the only part we had to figure out, was getting that other half lap. And Yeah, we had just enough to get there.
So when Jay and I talked to you on the infield during warm up, what was your instant thought? Like, you're going to do it.
Oh, I was like so excited because I felt amazing. I had no sleep. I had maybe 1 hour of sleep that night before. My friend from college was like calling me at 3 in the morning asking if he could take a shower because his water got turned off the night before. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. The phone rang 20 times and I finally picked up. I'm like, what in the world? And I pulled the phone out of the wall and then I slept for an hour and so I was really tired, but my body felt amazing. And so when when like Jay came up to me and mentioned it, I was just like, all right, let's do it. I was like, here we go. And I was so excited. Yeah, it changed everything for me. It made the nerves go away.
And in that 2000 race, we had a pre-race penalty,
Oh yeah, 4 seconds.
4 second penalty. And luckily, we chose a pit that was just before the penalty box.
Yep, and then that team got pulled the night before, so we were open on both teams.
Kai Alpha? No, Alpha.
Kai, oh, they're black, black jersey, number 3.
Something. Right.
I think it's Kyo, is it? Or is that a girls' team?
That's a girls' team, but they had a really strong rider. They had a really tall guy, muscles. He was really fast and strong.
Yep, for
Nurmer
him.
or something. So John Carlson starts the race
Yep.
because we were going to use you to serve the penalty and catch back on, right?
Right.
And this
Yeah.
is John's second little five. He was pretty reliable. He got second in ITT, so strength. But the entire field knew that we had a penalty. Right.
That's
So there wasn't much he was going to do any different than what he did, which was riding the pack. I think you had 20 laps to serve the penalty and maybe around 15 or so. He tried to get a gap, but it was fully marked.
Yeah.
Brought the bike into you. You tagged, ran to the penalty box, served the penalty. Like, what was that like for you? That was your first penalty serving.
Yeah, we practiced it. So it was just like everything else. I was excited to do it. Let's go. Every time there was like a, for me, like every time there was a problem, like something happened right before the race that wasn't supposed to happen, that was bad. I always like got amped up. I would overperform whenever something like that would happen. When I was overprepared, that's when I would like perform worse, it seemed like. When I got the call that we had a 4 second penalty, it didn't upset me as much as it did, like, all right, here we go. Like, it was like time to go. It's like I'm gonna fight harder than I ever fought before. And just so when I had to actually serve it, I was ready for it, and I didn't think it was gonna be a problem at all. I definitely knew that they were gonna try to put us a lap down right off the bat, so I was just hoping John could get, a little bit of a gap, but that was a pipe dream. And they
Yeah.
weren't gonna let go on that.
And then you close the gap pretty quick. It didn't take you long.
Yeah, it was 3 laps, I think. Yeah,
Was
it
it
was
that long?
I was motoring, but yeah, it was my first set, so I was totally fresh, and I just don't think they were expecting that so quickly, but
Mm-hmm.
yeah, back in the race, I didn't think that was going to hurt us too much, and luckily it didn't.
Then we go through the rotation. And then you get back on a bike for your second set. It's like lap 60 or so, if I remember right. What are you thinking when you're taking the bike? Do you know by then that you're ready, you're going to attack and take off?
Yeah, that was the point. I think I did a 28 lap first set or something like that, and then second set is where I was given the green light to go anywhere in that set where I felt like there was an opening. And so I was just chomping at the bit to wait for a really good gap, so I could follow it out. And I found it. The team that won the year before, Sigeps, went for a gap, and he actually got me. So I tried to get on his wheel right away, and again, that's why I'm glad I didn't have to sprint, because he got me, and I caught his wheel after a little while. And then once I had his wheel, it was like I was just relaxing. Like, it was almost like, I'm not even trying now. And then once I had like, once he pulled off, I felt like I was at full gas again. Like I didn't have, I was at 100% energy, ready to go. And then I could do a 12 lap, like all lap, all out time trial right there.
You know, we hadn't shared with your teammates that you were going to do this yet. So,
oh, really?
No. So, John,
I didn't even know that.
John, Greg, and Todd, or Tim, were all like, what's going on? What's he doing? And then we did, Jay and I were just saying, just let's just wait. We'll see what happens.
Who's but, Tim? Wait.
Bagwell, Todd. So they quickly realized like, this is what we're doing. And then quickly every other coach along the front straightaway steps out and looks at our pit, like wondering, what are these guys doing? Are they doing what we think we're doing? So you lay into it for how many laps you think you were on that first set?
It was a total of, I think, 32 lap set right there. And I think the last 12 were an all out ITT. And then I think either 12 to 15, I can't remember. But yeah, it was basically like, you know, those 5 mile time trials where I was able to get a half lap on the track. And I just basically tried to do the thing, same thing. I think I thought I probably could have done it in that one set, but I stopped making ground. And at that point I was just staying even. So, you know, eventually if people would have exchanged, it would have probably been bad. So it was a good idea to get me out of there when you did. And yeah, you had the right setup. Everything was set up like perfectly. All I had to do was do what I was asked to do and perform out there.
Yeah. Well, you performed. In fact, you threw up a few times. You were going so hard.
Oh yeah, that's in the yearbook that year. That was like that was the best part about that yearbook. It was huge puke coming out of my face. But yeah, that was a little scary because I completely my body shut down after that. My like legs were cramping on both sides and both legs, and I didn't think I was going to be able to get back on the bike. And if we had a crash or something, we were in deep trouble at that point, because I couldn't get back on the bike until there was about five laps to go, and even then my legs were very very affected by that.
So as we're in the process, or you're in the process of lapping the field with your team, like it takes a while, really. It's I don't know, it's 60 laps almost. It's a long time.
Yeah, it was a grind for sure.
Grind, and the field didn't let up and give you any space, really. They kept a pretty consistent pace.
Yeah, they didn't want to be left.
I think it took you three times to get on the bike.
Yeah, it was three. Yep, it was like another 12 lap time trial on my second set. That's when I thought my legs were. I thought my tire was flat, and you like I pointed at the bike, and you had another rider coming in for me, and the announcers were all geared up for me to come out, and then I kind of realized that my wheel was slipping a little bit and my legs were just gassed from not recovering enough from that first set. And I was like, what am I doing here? Like I was pointing at the bike, but I'm like, I don't think it's actually flat. And I'm like, I'm an idiot. Like I'm almost going to blow the brakes right now. And so you're like trying to pull me off. I'm like, no, I'm not going to blow it. So yeah, I almost had a brain fart there, but I came out of it in the right time.
And then we eventually get back around, and you end up being the rider that catches the back of the pack again, I think, right?
Yeah, like I got the half lap, and then Sproul and Carlson would do seven laps apiece, and then they would hold it. And then I got another quarter lap, and they would hold it. And right. Then I got the last quarter lap to close it.
We were close. We were on the same straightaway for a while, and it was still fragile. Like we could have lost it all. Somebody would have this had to come out earlier, but you get back on and close it. And what's that feeling when you're catching the back of the pack and you make your way back to the front and you know,
that fish song came on the radio, and it's like my favorite song. And it was like, I think it was like, this has all been wonderful. Now I'm on my way. That's actually, as I was lapping the field, like saluting the crowd, that's the lyrics that came out of the speakers. And I was like, this is surreal. Like it was so exciting. The crowd, there was 20,000 people there, and you know, I was just it was electric. It, like, I could hear everybody, I could see everybody, and like, it just, it felt like, you know, it was a celebration right there. The race was over. Like, I didn't even realize there was still another, whatever, 100 laps to go.
Right. You know, you love the Cutter stories and the old Delta Chi stories, and you did salute the crowd when you took the lap. Do you remember where that came from, or who you heard that from?
Oh yeah, for sure. The announcer, our friend from Delta Chi, what's his name?
Eddie Van Gise.
Eddie Van Gise, of course. He mentioned stories about when we'd win, we'd salute the crowd. I just kind of wanted to give a kudos to the old guys out there. I had so much respect for the older guys. It was like, I would talk about them all the time. You know, Dimitri and all those guys. But yeah, I just wanted to salute the crowd if I was able to do that. And it just happened, and yeah, I had to do it.
And then you're on the bike at the end as well for this race.
And yeah, I crawled on.
Your bike handling skills are a little better by then. And so you're taking the checker flag for the second time. Explain those emotions for you. Your last race, it was meaning so much for you. You put so much into it. You got to lap the field. You got to ride the race you wanted to ride.
Yeah. So it got a little hairy there at the end. You know, that other teams were like trying to attack a few times, and then we caught back on, and then they were ahead of us again, you know, when I got the bike. So like, my whole thought was like, I don't want to lose this lap. I don't want to finish like 3/4 of a lap ahead. Like, I know I left the field, but I want it to be cemented. So I just made sure to get on that wheel and then attack. And I figured they weren't going to follow me really, because they had to focus on each other, and it'd be kind of silly for them to worry about me at that point. So I just went on the way on the outside and just like flew around them and got another third of a lap so that I could just finish alone. And yeah, I was just thinking the whole time, like, just try to get your hands up and, you know, don't fall over. And yeah, you can see in some of the pictures that I'm like going up like this, like slowly up so I didn't crash anyone or myself.
Yeah, how tall are you?
6'5". Yeah, probably 6'6".
That frame doesn't fit you. So how did you get your body to fit on that little 5 frame at 6'5"?
I was ultra flexible. So I was really, really flexible in my back. So I could like put my palms on the ground, and so that was lucky for me, because having a big body, you have a good amount of power, but you're sucking in a lot of wind. So the fact that I was able to get really aero on a little tiny bike and still feel like I fit, I had to go 2 inches, like an inch past the max on the seat post, which is illegal. I probably could have bad happened, but that was the only way I could do it. I couldn't fit on that bike without like pulling that seat post almost all the way out of the thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, being tall is, you know, it posed some challenges for me, for my bike handling for sure. And I just wasn't naturally a bike handler, and, you know, just started cycling. So you start racing immediately with better guys, and it takes a while to develop that skill, I would say.
What would have made Little Five experience better for you? Anything?
No, I mean, you can't ask for more than I already got. No, I, you know, it would have been nice to win one men's race, but you guys wouldn't let that happen.
Yeah, I mean, as a coach.
As a coach, yeah. We got second in 2019 and with Caleb, and I mean, as close as I, you know, it felt like a win, just because the rider he was going against was awesome, and, you know, we knew it was going to be hard to beat him, but it was, you know, getting one win on the guys' race would have been the only thing that I could have done to cement everything, but I was really happy with everything, and I love Little Five, so I can't ask for more. Yeah, for sure.
I know you love it. If you were in charge of Little Five, would you change anything? Do you have any ideas to make it different or better?
I probably too many ideas to even share them here, but I mean, getting the track back in order and, you know, redone, resurfaced, and, you know, getting some timers like during the series events and making all that accurate. There's so many problems with timing over the years, but you know, they do their best. I can't complain too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But no, I think overall they do is a great job. You know, it's just, it's not easy. It's making everyone happy.
What would life be like without Little Five? Had you gone Purdue, you think? Like, of course you don't, there's no way of knowing, but I guess I'm surrounded by way of saying, how has Little Five like made you who you are today?
Yeah, I think it totally changed my life, and it you know, it took up a lot of my time for the last 20 years or more. So I might have been more focused on my career or something. You know, I might have been in a different sport, or maybe I would have started doing magic earlier. So, but yeah, I wouldn't have been in. I don't think I would have been a competitive cyclist, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't want it any other way. I'm glad the way it worked out. It's perfect.
What are you doing these days? Like, what fills your time in life?
Well, I'm married with two kids, the 9 and 7 year old, that are wonderful. And then I'm a magician now on the side. So I've been really building up my TikTok presence and had some really exciting things happening with all that, you know, like kind of out of the blue. So that's been really fun hobby for me. And then I just got a new job, you know, work at Thumbtack in sales. So it's really competitive environment. So I feel like I'm every day I go to work competing, and it's a lot of fun. And it kind of in some ways similar to Little Five, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Have you always been competitive? Like, is that
yeah,
part?
I'm like overly competitive to the point where I can't stand losing. And my dad was so competitive that he like wouldn't even play a board game. Like after he got out of like college, he didn't refuse to do any competitive things for 30 plus years because he hated losing so much. So luckily I was a little better than that, and I could accept losing, but I didn't like it, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. If you went back to your freshman self going into IU, like, what kind of advice would you have for you?
Yeah, I mean, as an adult, you have so much different perception of how everything works. So, you know, if I could be my adult self coming in as a writer, I think things have been a little smoother in terms of, you know, just building relationships and making the team a little bit better. But at the same time, like, then I'd be a different person and everything would have been a little bit different. So it's hard to say, but I just think getting that perception as an adult and realizing, you know, like some of the immature things that I've done, I would definitely take back. I was always trying to be funny and joking around, and sometimes at the expense of others, and you know, just maybe be a little bit nicer. But I don't think I was a jerk or anything. I just probably could have treated some guys a little better once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I mean, you were tough on your teammates at times. You didn't like to lose anything.
Yeah.
Maybe you push your teammates hard in places that could have been more relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been okay if John Carlson won ITTs in 2000, but you were determined to be on top, like at all costs, you know.
That would have hurt my confidence a little bit. But at the same time, he's on my team. But at the same time, it wouldn't have been good for me. I had to win that.
Yeah, you guys were 1-2 that year. That was fun. And
oh, that was, yeah, that was crazy. But
remember the lights in the stadium went out, and John didn't get to ride until like 11:30 or something.
Oh yeah, yeah. He had favorable wind though, so I was worried about it. I had to go at 4 p.m. and it was more windy out, so I was like, oh man, he might actually take this.
Yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. It's all good. He was very competitive too, and like I remember getting in a wrestling match with him like during one of our meetings, because he's like, I can beat you, and like he was like, you know, talking a little shit, and which is great, but it really brought out my like hell no, and like, yeah, I remember wrestling him down, put him in a chokehold. But yeah, I love those guys though. They were great teammates, to be honest. I wish I, yeah, you could do a little things differently, but it worked out and it was fun.
Yeah. You know, to go back to the very beginning, you said the perception you had of the Cutters before you joined it, that they were this pro level team. But as you went through it, like you realize we take whoever shows up.
Yeah.
As long as you're not an asshole. As long as you're not an asshole and you don't quit, like you have a chance.
Yeah, it's always a work in progress. There's always guys that aren't quite training hard enough. And then there's always guys that, you know, want to train harder, but they just can't make the time or whatever. And so you're always trying to find those pieces to make it a little bit better. This guy needs to lose 5 pounds. This guy, you know, things like silly things like that. But, you know, they were important, but at the same time, you can't control everything. So just got to make it work.
Yeah. And you've become one of those old folks now, those old guys that you saluted to. You know, what's that like being part of the alumni group?
I mean, it's different because I've been coaching other teams, outside of Cutters. So I don't really know the guys as intimately on your side. I know my guys, and I know, you know, obviously the girls. So I'm just a lot more relaxed nowadays, and I'm a lot more accepting of mistakes, and I'm not as hard as I used to be. And you know, sometimes that might be a negative on my coaching, actually. I'm not as critical, and I always just try to facilitate and help. And maybe I lost some of that ultra competitive toughness, but at the same time, I'm glad I did. It's kind of a switch in my personality.
I think it's better for longevity of everything. Coaching business.
Relationships. Yeah. Everything.
Bobby Knight doesn't coach anymore. You know?
Yeah.
The coaches who can be more flexible and listen to the athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good balance. And all the riders are different. So you might have one team that you can do this with and another team's completely different. And so, yeah, you gotta find that right balance every time. It's not always easy.
There's some alumni races every now and then. Have you ever pinned a number up for those?
No, but I'm always like, you know, whenever I get back on the bike for a couple of days, I still feel good. But no, I haven't done any of that. And if I do, it would I would want to take it seriously. I would actually want to train for like a year before I even put that out there, because I don't want to just embarrass myself. But yeah, never say never on that.
What was Little Five like? Your peers? What was your relationship with your competition while you rode?
Yeah, I didn't really know them that well. We kind of kept to ourselves as the Cutters, and there was no online presence when I first started. And right after I won the first race, that's when like the online stuff about Little Five pedals and spokes and all that was kind of created in its first edition. And that's when all the trash talking started happening. And I was always the keyboard warrior defending my honor. And it actually kept me like motivated and fighting, you know, and like wanting to win so bad, but just sucked up a lot of my time. It's probably silly, but, you know, it was exciting. And yeah, that first year I didn't really know anybody. I didn't really become friends with any riders outside of our team until my senior year, when I was doing a lot of IUCC stuff. Mm-hmm. And I started hanging out with, the Burns brothers from SAE, who I love. Those guys are hilarious. You know, and a couple other guys, but really, Sonneborn was cool. And, but yeah, really just kept to ourselves and did our own thing as much as we could. Didn't get involved with all the parties and stuff after the race a little bit, but you know, really not so much back then.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, any other highlights or any like big thoughts of your time on the Cutters or Little Five?
No, I mean, I had a great experience coaching Teeter. That was a lot of fun, like the team pursuit record and having Caitlin and her team with Susan and Dana and, Emma and Lauren, like those guys, Those guys, that was a lot of fun. That was an incredible experience. I think we won six team pursuits and got to smash the record. And yeah, I don't know. In total, we were like, I've been second five times, and we've won. My teams have won five times as a rider and coach. And yeah, it's just been a real wild, fun ride. But yeah, Teeter was a big part of that too. And then this last few years with the Bears was fun. The whole thing has been a great experience, and now it's like coming full circle and kind of winding down my time as coach, and maybe now I'll be able to watch the race from a different perspective again, and that'll be fun too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made an impact on the men's race and the women's race as a coach, and the men's race as a rider for sure. Big impact. You got to feel proud about that. Your legacy there.
Yeah, you guys showed me the way. And then, yeah, remember that pit that we took that first year? I got to say something about that, because that, like, now that is the focus of, like, every team. You know, if you can get that corner pit, you know, on the opposite side, and we got a 19th position. Could you imagine someone that picked 19th nowadays? Like, that kind of changed the race a little bit right there, you know? But, yeah, no, it was a lot of fun, everything, every bit of it.
We were always good at innovating and trying to solve those unique problems. Like when we got the penalty, and when we would lose riders.
You still are. You guys still are. Like, I think it froze for a second there, but
yeah, we still do try to innovate, like in different ways. And
oh, for sure.
You were great to have around, because you were great at bouncing ideas off of and trying new things and looking outside the typical ways.
Mm. Yeah, you guys do better than me though at that, I'll tell you. Nobody would have guessed that 30 lap set. What's his name?
Noble.
Noble. I know his name. I'm old. But yeah, that was one. It's such an exciting race, and every time the Cutters win, it's super exciting, even if it's not my team. You know, it's like, I can't believe they pulled it out. And just the last few years, even though the track has been terrible and we've had to deal with COVID and all that, the race is still so exciting. And so it'll be fun to kind of watch as a fan and sometime in the future.
But I've told you this before, it is your team. It's still your team.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a family. You're always, you know, once you're born into that, it'll never leave you. That's for sure.
Well, in closing this up, I really do want to thank you for everything you've done for the team and subsequently for me, because like I said, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be who I am. I know that.
Oh, thank you. I know.
Silly bike race and
mutual, man.
The people who took it, who loved it as much as I did.
I got a huge picture of you and me, and like right down in my basement, like just in a big glass case, like after we won that first race, and that was your first year coaching, and that was magic right there. And so wouldn't change it for the world. Yeah. And you guys got something going, like you being in town and being that historian and facilitating it works so well. I can't say it enough how you can really turn these riders on to what it takes to be a championship team. And it's hard to do.
I've come back circle on the complexity of coaching. Like, you got to keep it simple. And the right people come to you, and you just got to light their fire and let them be themselves. And because I can't be more excited than them. That doesn't work. I've tried that.
Great point. That's an excellent point. You're 100% right.
So the riders got to bring the fire and the energy and the heart and the soul. And when they do, magic can happen, like it did in 97 and all those other years.
Yeah. And I did want to say, like, you know, what also helped me was, you know, obviously Jay Palsgrove was my, was training me those last 2 years. Eric Gullett, I think he wrote the workouts that first year. And, you know, just want to give some credit to those guys as well. But yeah, I mean, without you, none of that would have been possible. I don't think, you know, we were just kind of like falling apart. It would have been different. You brought it back together, and it was perfect.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad it worked out the way it did. Thank you, man. Love you. I look forward to seeing you this April.
Hugs. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely, Jim.
Let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Bye
Bye-bye.
bye.